From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, litigation that has surrounded the overcrowding in California's prisons for years, even decades, is finally reaching its climax. Recently, a panel of three federal judges has ordered that the state reduce its prison population by the end of January about 8% or else. With the threat of early releases or the prospect of spending hundreds of millions of more dollars to house state inmates before the governor, the legislature, and law enforcement, the question of prison overcrowding is now front and center at the state capitol. How do we get to this point, and what are the short and long-term solutions to California's chronic prison overcrowding? We'll ask Drew Soderberg, the California Legislative Analyst Office expert on prison issues, and Dan Moraine, senior editor at the Sacramento Bee. We'll also hear from Bakersfield Police Chief Greg Williamson, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, and Dr. Emma Hughes, a professor of criminology at California State University Fresno and an expert in rehabilitation programs. California's Prisoner's Dilemma.
From Fresno, the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. The overcrowding in California prisons has been an ongoing issue spanning decades. Faced with an increasingly impatient federal court panel, the heat is on the governor and the legislature to provide what the court called a, quote, durable solution to this decades-old problem. Our first guest is Drew Soderberg, who is an expert in prison issues with the California Legislative Analyst Office. Welcome to the Maddie Report. I understand also you did a recent report called Addressing the Federal Court Prison Population Cap, so hopefully you can give us some of the information from that report. So why don't you help our audience with the state prison population problem. What's going on there?
Well, essentially what happened is in 2009, a federal three-judge panel found that the state was unable to provide a constitutional level of health care to its inmates, given the current level of overcrowding. At that point, the federal courts ordered the state to reduce its prison population to about 137.5% of design capacity.
So my recollection is reading your report, you were saying that initially we were 200% over capacity. They brought it down to only 148% of capacity, but the court wants it at 137% of capacity, correct?
That's correct.
So in 2011, Governor Brown attempted to address this problem with something called realignment. Mm-hmm. What is realignment and how much did it reduce California's prison population?
So essentially, the 2011 realignment was a series of bills, most notably AB 109, that shifted responsibility for certain offenders from the state to local government. Now, it was intended to reduce the prison population, and the way it did that was essentially by requiring that after October 2011, certain offenders could no longer be placed in prison, instead had to remain under county jurisdiction. Now, since the law was passed, the state's prison population has gone down by about 24,000 inmates, or about 17%.
Quite substantial.
It is a substantial change.
You know, it's interesting in terms of art. It's called a state prison, but a county jail.
That's correct.
And I think people sometimes just kind of mix those terms together, but they're really different. In 2013, the administration notified the federal court that it wouldn't be able to meet its imposed cap, down to 110,000 state prisoners. What did the court say about that?
So essentially what the court did is it ordered the state to start beginning taking action to bring it into compliance. And what the court did is it ordered the state to house more offenders in fire camps because offenders that are in fire camps aren't counted towards the prison population limit. Similarly, it ordered the state to maintain its out-of-state contracts because, again, those offenders aren't counted towards the limit. And finally, it ordered the state to take various actions that would result in the early release of about 6,000 offenders.
So the governor responded to the court. What do you think about his response? Was it a good short-term and long-term solution?
Well, essentially what the governor did, he first appealed, but then when the appeal wasn't successful, the governor asked the legislature for about $315 million to purchase about 12,500 contract beds.
And that's in 1 year?
That's correct. That's okay. Correct. And now the strength of the plan is that it would theoretically result in compliance if we were able to activate those beds in time. The drawback is that it was really only a short-term solution because those contracts were set to expire and the prison population was growing.
Wasn't he also talking about another $400 million in years 2 and 3?
That's correct. So the plan envisioned that the state would continue to maintain these contracts over a period of time, and that was the amount of funding that they thought would be necessary. Specifically, they thought about $315 million in the first year and $400 million in the second year. Now, they did have a plan to bring forward to the legislature some options that would that could result in long-term compliance other than just contracting. But they weren't specific on what those options would be, and those options wouldn't be presented to the legislature until the contracts were about set to expire. So it wouldn't give the legislature a lot of time to react to the proposals.
So the Republicans in the legislature and the Assembly Democrats agreed with the governor, but the Senate Democrats had a different idea. What was their idea?
That's right. So essentially what the Senate's response was to try to enter into negotiations with the plaintiffs. Their plan assumed that the state would sit down with the plaintiffs and negotiate for more time to comply with the limit and potentially adjusting what that limit was. The plan also contained a provision that the state would set up a grant program to incentivize counties to reduce the number of offenders they send to state prison.
Okay, so you guys at the LAO's office had recommendations about what the state might do to meet its short and long-term obligations in terms of reducing overcrowding in prisons. What were they?
Well, at this point, our office hasn't come down specifically on what we recommend the state should do, but we have said that there are various options that the state should consider. One of the options is reducing recidivism, so reducing the number of people that return to prison after getting released.
And that number I read somewhere is about 70%?
That's correct. It depends on how you measure it, but it's around 65 to 70%, depending on how recidivism is measured. Mm-hmm. The other options that the state has is to consider additional contract capacity or making changes in sentencing law to reduce the size of the prison population.
Well, that's a very factual background on the prison problem. I want to thank Drew Soderborg. I apologize for mispronouncing your name earlier, from the Legislative Analyst Office. We're now joined by Dan Moraine, senior editor at the Sacramento Bee and longtime observer of state politics, to discuss one of the top political issues this year, the ongoing federal lawsuit over overcrowding in California prisons. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, recently the governor and the Senate pro tem reached an agreement to address the prison population issue. What was that agreement?
Well, it started out with the governor, the Speaker of the Assembly, the Senate Minority Leader, and the Assembly Minority Leader all getting together in a big press conference with lots of law enforcement behind them and announcing a big settlement. Well, there was a big missing link, and that was President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, who was adamantly opposed to this proposal that the governor had come up with. So they fought for a couple weeks. They were back and forth, but they ended up settling, and Steinberg gave some. I think the governor gave less than what Steinberg did.
So
there's going to be a little bit more money for mental health care, okay, which is what Steinberg wanted, a little bit more money for rehabilitation, but there's still going to be about $300 million for additional bed space in the state of California.
So the governor presented that agreement to a three-judge federal panel overseeing the prison overcrowding litigation, and he asked basically for a three-year phase-in period. How did the panel rule?
Well, he didn't get it. He's just not winning before the federal courts here. So
he got a little something.
He got 1 month. You know, that's a one-month stay of execution, and then he's got to figure out, he's got to come up with a plan for reducing crowding. Now, he doesn't have to release inmates, and he's vowed he's not going to do that, and so his solution is going to be to buy more bed space.
So we're talking about 10,000 inmates, correct?
That's 9,000, 8,000, 9,000 is what they need.
Okay, yeah, because that number seems to fluctuate a little bit, but one possible solution that was floated by the governor was to send several thousand of those prisoners out of state. The three-judge panel didn't like that idea, and they said, you know, stop.
Right.
Don't do any more of that until you work something out. But doesn't that pretty much limit the governor in terms of what he can do?
There's not a lot the governor can do. So the solution, his solution, and the solution of Jeffrey Beard, the Secretary of the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, is to buy bed space in private prisons. So part of that's going to entail having to bring these private prisons up to state code. So it's not an inexpensive solution, but that's their main solution at this point.
And who would be the guards at those private prisons? Would they be public employees or private employees?
Well, that's the thing. The benefit, to the extent that there is a benefit in using private prisons, is that they're lower costs. And the reason lower costs, or one of the reasons, is that labor costs are far lower. Well, California's deal is that the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, which represents prison officers, is going to staff these prisons. So whatever cost savings there might have been is out the window. We're going to be paying to upgrade these facilities, and we're going to be paying state labor costs, which are higher than private guards.
What about reducing sentences for minor crimes? Is that an option?
Well, the governor is convinced that it is not an option. He's done it already. He feels as if he has reduced prison population as much as he can reduce it safely. I mean, think about when Schwarzenegger was governor, not very long ago, there were 176,000 inmates in California state prisons. Now there are 119,000. That is a massive drop. That's on historic levels.
But they're not releasing these prisons. These prisoners are going to county jails.
Some are out on the streets. Some are in county jails. They're not getting released out the back door. They have served their time, and they're out. And then there have been changes in the law that allow the state to not bring them back into prison. And so many of them go into county jail. Many of them are on the street.
You know, some charge that there's still lots of elderly and disabled inmates that could be released that pose no threat to society. The administration says, no, that's not true. All these low-risk prisoners have already been released or sent to county jails during realignment. Who's right?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And you know, I've done enough crime stories over the years. I've done enough stories about parolees who have committed really bad things. You know, my bias is generally that the people who are running the prisons probably have a better idea about who is safe to be released and who is not. Now, you know, are there some people among that 119,000 who could be fine on the outside? No doubt there are.
It's just not.
Do you want to pick them? I'm not going to pick them. You know, somebody who knows a lot more about criminal justice than I know has to make that decision.
Yeah, and we're talking 10,000 people. You know, part of the ruling the federal judges had was they ordered the state officials to confer with inmate lawyers to try to work something out. Do you think there's any possible solution that's going to be found between those two groups?
Well, you know, that's certainly what Daryl Steinberg had envisioned. He had envisioned that Jerry Brown would sit down with plaintiff's lawyers and work this out. I don't think Jerry Brown wants to do that much. At some point, there's going to have to be a settlement. Otherwise, this is going to go on and on and on and on. But I don't see it happening.
What's the reason? What's the reason for that? What do you
think?
Well,
you know, I think the governor... No governor is used to being told what to do, especially by judges. So I think the governor is a little bit stubborn here. I mean,
Is there a trust issue here as well?
Well, he's been working on this lawsuit since he was attorney general, right? So this goes back 7 years. He's been enmeshed in this case. He's had multiple press conferences where he's come out and harangued, just gone after the plaintiff's lawyers here, the inmates' lawyers. You know, I think the inmates' lawyers are sort of rightly a little skeptical that he's willing to deal. So I think this goes on for a little bit longer.
You know, it seems like everybody agrees that rehabilitation is a good idea. So let's say there is no agreement between the inmate lawyers and the governor, but the state puts substantial resources behind a rehabilitation effort. Do you think that's going to sway the federal court to grant an extension, or are they going to say, no, you still need to reduce your prison population?
No, the court is adamant. The court wants that percentage down. They want crowding down. The court is convinced that the state cannot provide health care and mental health care to the level that it thinks is necessary, is constitutional, at its current level of crowding. So, the state can spend, and I think does spend, money on rehabilitation. But it's not going to be enough.
Carrot just won't be big enough?
I just don't think it will be. It hasn't been yet. And the state has spent billions trying to comply with this lawsuit. I mean, billions. They've built entire new wings of prisons. I was at San Quentin 3 weeks ago, and I saw the facade of the new prison hospital there. It's it's an incredible edifice. Mm-hmm. Not cheap. There's a new prison hospital over in Stockton. You know, these are big facilities.
It sounds like you've kind of got a situation where you have this unstoppable force and this immovable object. You know, the federal judges nor governors want to be told what to do. Yeah. And so they're both kind of digging in their heels, it sounds like, a little bit.
Yeah, well, and these judges have been around for a long time. Thelton Henderson, Lawrence Carlton, and Stephen Reinhardt, they go back a long ways. And they've seen a lot, and they're not easily swayed.
Well, okay, so the governor has appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn that three-judge order on the 9,600 inmates. What are the odds that the Supreme Court are going to rule in the governor's favor?
Well, Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, is the only Californian on the court. He wrote the decision that led to this new order, this latest order. I just don't see him changing his mind. I mean, he wrote a very strong opinion back in 2010. Was appalled by what he had learned about the California prison system. Now, much of it's out of date, but still, I think he's going to leave it. It's going to leave it in the hands of these three judges.
Even though it's a fairly conservative U.S. Supreme Court.
It is a conservative Supreme Court, and Anthony Kennedy is nobody's liberal, and Reinhardt, Henderson, and Carlton are quite liberal. I think he's just decided that this is not something that he's going to get back in the middle of, even though there are members of the court who would like to get in the middle of it. I don't think they've got the votes.
You know, it's interesting. This isn't the only current litigation on prisoners in California. There was a trial going on in Sacramento regarding the use of force. There was also a recent federal court of appeals decision rebuking California for failing to protect disabled inmates. So it seems to have a lot of litigation in the state around the state's prison system. And folks may be wondering, you know, who's the problem here? Is it the state? Is it the inmates and their lawyers? Is it the courts?
Well, you know, inmates have time on their hands. They've got not a lot to do. Many of them are perfectly smart enough to read a law book and know that they can file a habeas corpus petition. Inmates, lawyers, this is their stock and trade. They make money off this. They care about it. I've never met a prisoner's rights lawyer who wasn't a true believer, but it's also their living. And the state and the person of Jerry Brown, pretty stubborn.
You know, that issue is kind of an important issue. It reduced the prison population substantially, but people don't really know whether or not it's working. In fact, the state auditor, Elaine Howe, recently released a report which states, quote, "The state does not currently have access to reliable and meaningful data concerning realignment. As a result, the impact of realignment cannot be fully evaluated at this time. Even so, initial data indicate that local jails may not have adequate capacity and services to handle the influx of inmates caused by realignment." And she basically says she considers this a high-risk situation. What are your thoughts on realignment?
Well, I think she was absolutely right. There is a real lack of data. So one of the things that those of us who are trying to pay attention to realignment have to deal in is anecdotes. And people who tell the stories often are often telling them through their own political prism. So we're sort of at a loss. We don't know what the true statistics are. Now, I do know that the Public Policy Institute of California has started gathering the data, getting it finally from the California Attorney General's office and from other sources. And so in next year, we ought to start getting a picture, a glimpse of how it's working.
You know, she's calling it a high-risk issue. Does that mean this is the next place where we're going to see litigation?
Well, we're already seeing it. So even if the governor settles this lawsuit involving health care and mental health care in the state prison system, prisoners' rights attorneys already have filed lawsuits against Fresno County, I believe Monterey County. There are lawsuits out there over county jail conditions. And as you know, these are the places that house many, many, many of the most mentally ill people in the state of California, the county jails.
And county jails really weren't designed for long holds, right?
No,
and they were supposed to go to state prisons.
They weren't. And now we've got the phenomenon under realignment of essentially prison type sentences, multiple years, people doing those sentences in county jails. Absolutely, this is going to be this is the new frontier in prison litigation.
You hear a lot about the costs of housing inmates. Talk a lot about the state spends more on prisons than they do on universities. What's driving those costs? Is it long sentences? Is it prisoner health care? Is it guard pay?
Well, I think it's all of the above. Healthcare is a huge driver. It has been for years. I started writing about this in a serious way in the 1990s, and healthcare was going up at a geometric level, and it still is. So, that's a big driver. These are not the healthiest people.
What do you think the short and long term solutions are to this problem?
I'm not sure what the short-term solution is. I think ultimately what the state is going to have to grapple with is its sentencing structure. When Jerry Brown was governor the first time, he changed the sentencing system from indeterminate sentences to determinate sentences. So you get a fixed sentence for a fixed crime.
So the judge doesn't have a lot of flexibility to take other things into consideration.
Very little flexibility, and the parole boards don't have any flexibility. So, somebody's sentenced to 10, 12, 15 years, they're going to do the bulk of that time. Now, under indeterminate sentencing, some people got out who never should have gotten out, but at least it did give some flexibility to parole boards for people who reformed themselves in prison. There's not that flexibility. So I think at some point, and I hope it's soon, the state convenes a sentencing panel, really smart people on it, judges, criminologists, people who truly understand the system, and start taking a look at the sentences top to bottom.
What about recidivism? I mean, the prisoners that return to prison, there's a very high rate, 65-70% go back to jail.
Sure.
What's a way to stop that revolving door?
Well, who knows? If we could solve that, we would solve so much of the problem.
Well, some people say rehabilitation.
Well,
works.
Yeah, some people just aren't able to be rehabilitated, it's a big problem. One of the things that we have to pay attention to is when we as a state and as a society say something, we ought to mean it. So a sentence that is life in prison without parole needs to be life in prison without parole. The flip side is that we ought to at least, I think, give the possibility that some people can be rehabilitated and maybe get out before they're 80 years old.
Well, let me ask you this one last question. The PPIC came out with a poll recently and said that 52% of the respondents said violence and street crimes are not much of an issue in their community. In addition, 55% of likely voters said their local government was doing enough to reduce crime. Only 39% said it wasn't. So is crime becoming less important of a hot-button political issue?
It is until you get mugged. I think or until your car gets broken into or your car gets stolen, then it becomes a very big issue. But on a broader level, all we need is one polyclass, one Richard Allen Davis getting out of prison on parole and kidnapping a beautiful young girl and
changes everything.
And then it's front page news.
Oh, there you go. Well, I want to thank Dan Moraine from the Sacramento Bee, also Drew Soderborg with the California Legislative Analyst, for joining us.
What impact is the state prison overcrowding issue having on the San Joaquin Valley? We'll talk to Bakersfield Police Chief Greg Williamson, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, and Dr. Emma Hughes, a professor of criminology at California State University Fresno and an expert in rehabilitation programs.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the overcrowding in the state prison system, but what are the implications for the San Joaquin Valley? We have three perspectives on that issue: Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, Bakersfield Police Chief Greg Williamson, and Dr. Emma Hughes, a professor of criminology at Fresno State. Welcome all of you to the Matty Report Valley Views Edition.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great. Chief Dyer, let's start with you. I wanted to ask you about crime in the Valley. You generally read that crime is down in the country generally and statewide. What about in Fresno? Is crime down?
Well, overall crime is down, both violent crime and property crime. In fact, as this morning, violent crime is down 8.2%, and property crimes are down 12.7%. I hesitate a little bit on the property crime category because there are some things that have occurred that cause underreporting to occur, especially with crimes like vehicle burglary. But we have no doubt that violent crime is down, and primarily because that's where we put our attention, our efforts, our proactive resources in making sure that violent crime is a priority for the organization. Property crime has been the challenge for us in terms of burglaries and larcenies, auto theft in particular. We have seen in the last 3 months or so that auto theft has began to trend upwards significantly. In fact, over the last 28 days, we've had a 45.9% increase in auto theft over the previous 28 days. So those numbers are starting to trickle up, and primarily because of a lack of consequences for those individuals that we arrest for auto theft.
Chief Williamson, are you seeing the same thing in Bakersfield?
Not quite the same. We haven't had quite as good luck as Chief Dyer has in Fresno. After the start of the realignment in 2012, our crime rate went up significantly, about 18%. That includes about 3,000 additional property crimes from what we had the year before, and that was after 6 years of straight decline. Now, this year, we've had a little bit better luck, and as of last month, our crime stats come out today, actually, we were down about 3.1%. So we're making a little bit more headway this year, but last year was just a devastating year for crime in the city of Bakersfield.
Professor Hughes, I'm wondering, what about region-wide? Are there different trends, North Valley, Central Valley, South Valley?
Well, I mean, I think what the statements of the two chiefs point to is that there is variation, not just in the valley, but around the state as a whole. And we do see little changes from time to time, and we did notice across the state that starting in 2011, there were slight increases in property crime in many parts of the state, but then other parts of the state had decreases, and slight increases in violent crime around the state in some areas in 2012, where some places saw a decrease. And I think the overall thing to keep in mind is that across the state, for both property and violent crime, the crime rates are about the lowest they've been in about 40 years.
Okay. Well, Chief Williamson, I want to ask you about the criminal justice system and the really big change that's been going on, and that is a realignment with more state prisoners and parolees being sent to county jails or placed on county probation. This is going to be a short question, but probably a long answer. What are your thoughts on realignment?
To tell you the truth, I think it caught law enforcement on their heels. I don't think that anybody was prepared to deal with some of the challenges. I think, like the professor said, some communities had better luck than others, but certainly in our county that was not the case. Problematic for us is that we're under a federal cap at our jail as well. And so every time, well, right now the sheriff would tell us that if we arrest 60 people in one day, 60 people are coming out the next day, and so he has to classify accordingly. So what we're seeing out there right now is drug offenders who need to steal stuff to get their drugs. They generally aren't the best people. And so I think that's to pinpoint the property crimes. I think that's been a huge problem. And like Chief Dyer, we throw a lot of resources at the violent crime, and sometimes just visibility and ongoing pressure on those groups will reduce those crimes. So I don't know that release of the prisoners has been the problem. The problem is that we have more criminals in our society because the prisons aren't taking more people due to sentencing guidelines, plus our jail is full as well.
Well, Chief Dyer, what are your thoughts on realignment?
Well, I think it was much what Chief Williamson said. It was, for us, it was too much too soon. I was well aware of what was going to occur as a result of the Coleman and Plata lawsuit that was lodged against the state in terms of prison overcrowding and so forth. So I knew something was going to come because we were working toward that when I was the president of the California Police Chiefs Association. But it wasn't dealt with at the state level. And then all of a sudden, it had to be dealt with because the courts rendered a decision that required them to downsize the prison population. Communities across California were not prepared for that. We were not prepared for it in terms of bed space at the jails, treatment facilities. Probation wasn't prepared to take over the supervision role of those numbers of individuals that state parole used to supervise. So it was too much too soon. It was like trying to take a drink out of a fire hose for law enforcement and our communities, and we've seen the impact. And so, you know, when I talk about our property crimes being down this year, I have to be mindful of the fact that property crimes went up 3 years prior to that, 16% in 2010, 4% in 11, and 1% in 12. So our reductions are compared to a 21% increase over 3 years. Well, what Fresno was different than most jurisdictions, I believe, because 3 years ago, prior to realignment, because of some budgetary constraints, the sheriff closed down three floors of the jail. So we lost over 1,200 jail beds. That's when we started to see our crime rise in terms of property crime. And what happened when realignment came, it simply became exacerbated. Yes, funding has come from the state, and it has allowed the sheriff to open up two floors of the jail, but those are for inmates that would have otherwise been in the state prison. Mm-hmm. So we're still minus those 800 beds. So I just believe that when the state, you know, there was an attempt to reform the prison system and the parole system, that was a good thing because everyone admitted that it was not working properly. But when you try to do reform and save money for the state at the same time, it's not done in a manner in which it should be.
Yeah, it's probably could be a double whammy for law enforcement. But I want to ask Professor Hughes, what are your thoughts on realignment? Is it working?
Well, one of the things about realignment is that it's like there are 58 different versions of realignment because there are 58 different counties, and each county can apply the new process in different ways. And if ultimately realignment just becomes about shifting the overcrowding in the prison population to increased overcrowding in the jail population, as we already know, many counties like Fresno had overcrowding in the jails before realignment, then all we've done is shift the problem from one place and make it worse in another place. But you know, my understanding is that really the intention behind realignment was to be more creative in the use of alternatives to incarceration where appropriate, to use community-based corrections, that programs that are tried and tested through evidence-based research, and to, you know, where possible, for instance, give a split sentence so that someone would spend some time in jail and then some time in the community supervised by probation officers and receiving both surveillance and treatment supervision. So those are the kinds of things that could make realignment be effective. But if it just becomes about overcrowding the jails and then having people released early without any kind of supervision, having had no kind of treatment programming whilst they were in jails, then it's not going to be effective, in my opinion.
You know, the state has already reduced its prison population by, it's hard to find the number sometimes, but it sounds like between 20 and 25,000 inmates. But the federal courts are still saying, listen, you've got to reduce it by another 10,000 or so out of a total population of about 120,000. But it said that the state can't put those inmates out of state. So it's kind of, it seems like some folks are saying that the court is really tying the governor's hands and saying, you know, almost pushing toward early release. Professor Hughes, do you think that the federal courts are pushing kind of an early release program?
Well, my understanding is that right now there are discussions going on between the lawyers for the inmates in the Brown v. Plata case and the state, CDCR and the governor, to discuss possibly having a longer-term solution that would require more time to reduce the prison population, according to the Brown v. Plata ruling. So, you know, I think there's supposed to be a preliminary report to the federal judges who are overseeing this towards the end of this month. And I believe the state has until late January to kind of reach potentially some agreement with the lawyers for the inmates. So I think it's still very much up in the air what will be required by the federal judges.
Yeah, there's some discussion that we had in the earlier part of the show about whether or not the trust exists for a negotiated settlement between the governor and the inmates' lawyers. But I know there are still folks that are saying, listen, the federal courts are pushing for an early release because they're implying that there are these disabled, elderly, or low-risk inmates that could be released without causing a problem. So, Chief Dyer, what are your thoughts about the early release of these low-risk inmates? Chief Dyer, I think we may have lost Chief Dyer. Why don't we go to Chief Williamson?
Yeah, you did.
Chief Williamson, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, if they're still in there, I wouldn't consider them low-risk inmates. They may have those debilitating diseases still, but if they're still in custody at this point and he hasn't released them after the 25,000 that have already, I would still consider them some risk.
Do we get Chief Dyer back on the line?
Yes, I'm okay, great.
Chief, let me ask you the question as well. This release of supposedly low-risk inmates, if folks are saying, oh, listen, they're disabled or elderly or low-risk folks that you can release to get another 10,000 inmates out of the state prisons. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it has to be done on a case-by-case basis, depending on the individual inmate, their history within the prison. But I believe it's a misnomer to think that just because someone is in a wheelchair or they're elderly in age or they're older in age, that they are no longer a threat to society, because those individuals can still be very, very dangerous. I would say that Charlie Manson is a person who is really up in age and, perhaps some might consider him no longer a threat. But the reality is he's a very dangerous individual. Because he can cause people to do things, as was shown in his history, that people otherwise wouldn't do. So I don't think you can just say anybody that is has these medical issues or of a certain age can be automatically released. It has to be done on an individual basis.
Okay. Well, Professor Hughes, I want to ask you about this whole issue of mental health. Has the criminal justice system become another place to deal with mental health? And how big a problem is mental health dealing when you're talking about crime?
Well, it is a huge problem. And I mean, I think one of the things that really brings that to light is the number of inmates in sort of the largest jail systems around the country that are receiving treatment every day for mental health issues. For instance, just a couple of weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal released a report on this, and it really, identifies the fact that over 11,000 inmates every day receiving mental health treatment in the L.A. County jail system, the New York City jail system, and the Cook County, Illinois jail system, which includes Chicago. So that's a huge number of people that are receiving mental health care that could potentially be receiving that care under other circumstances. And just to put it further in perspective, that number of 11,000 inmates is equivalent to 28% of all of the beds in the nation's state psychiatric hospitals. So it really shows what a burden the jail system and also the prison system is carrying in having to treat and look after inmates with mental health issues in an environment that was not set up for that kind of treatment.
Chief Dyer, are you seeing that on the streets, that your officers are dealing with a lot of folks with mental health issues?
Yeah, that's become one of the primary concerns for officers out in the field today. Individuals that are out there that are not either taking their medication or not receiving the appropriate treatment. And that has become a significant problem for us. In fact, we commit probably 8 individuals a day or greater under the Welfare and Institution Code 5150, where the individual is perceived to be a danger to themselves or others. And there's probably another 30 or 40 calls that we handle a day where we're dealing with mental health issues. So it's a significant problem for us. I know it is a significant problem inside the jail. And they're not getting the treatment that they could or should. And I'm not sure that as a society we're able to afford the type of treatments that they do need.
So, Chief Williamson, I'm guessing you're dealing with the same thing in Bakersfield. Should we be spending more money on mental health, more resources on dealing with the mental health issue, so they don't end up at the jail or the jail? Well, I was going to say the prison system, but they're going out of the county jail. So is that something we should be spending more money on?
Yes, I know in our county, through our community corrections partnership, we gave our mental health department a good chunk of the money. At our department, we've been have a very good relationship with our mental health unit, and actually have mental health professionals come out to our calls when we're dealing with those individuals. But as I talk to our officers day in and day out, they're dealing more and more with individuals who have mental health issues.
Okay, well, up next, what are the long-term solutions to the overcrowding in California's prisons? Build more prisons? Or do we try to steer more folks away from a life of crime? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So what are the short and long-term solutions to the overcrowding in California's prisons, and what does it mean for the Valley? We're talking with Bakersfield Police Chief Greg Williamson, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, and Dr. Emma Hughes, a professor of criminology at California State University, Fresno. So Professor Hughes, what about just simply building more prison cells?
Well, I don't think that's the solution. It's not a problem we can just build our way out of. No sooner do you build more prison cells, they fill up, and then you're stuck with the same problem. So I think finding a long-term solution is the way to approach this. There is public support, according to opinion polls, for using community corrections where possible, particularly with low-risk nonviolent offenders. And so diverting out of the prison system where possible to engage in programs in the community that do actually show themselves to be effective in reducing reoffending. And I think that, you know, the prison system so far hasn't actually released any inmates earlier than they would have done before realignment. That has happened in the jails, of course, but not in the prisons. And if you want to find a long-term solution to avoiding doing that, then we need to think about what can be done differently in the community.
Okay, well, Chief Williamson, what do you think? We can't build our way out of this problem?
I agree with Professor Hughes. We can't build our way out of this crime problem. And really, we have to play both sides against the middle, and we have to work with our youth and keep them occupied after school, those types of things. Keep them into school. We have to work with their parents as well to make sure they're getting the proper parenting. For those who have fell on the wrong side of the law, they need to get better programs when they're captivated in state custody or local custody, and be given opportunities so that when they reenter society, they can have a chance to get a job, get a driver's license, finish their school, whatever their goal is. And then we have to continue to have that long-term interaction with those individuals so that we can hopefully get on top of this and make it a long-term solution.
Well, Chief Dyer, let me try this from a different angle. What about sending prisoners out of state or to contract facilities?
Well, the state of California has done that and done that very effectively. And I know that is a solution, perhaps a short-term solution more than a long-term. The same is true in taking advantage of some of the facilities up and down the state that were housing state inmates originally. But all of those were closed down, leaving them vacant. And those have to be taken advantage of again by the state. I think that is not only a short-term solution, but long-term as well. And when you look at what the long-term solutions are, generally the answers you get are either or, either prisons, build more prisons, or treatment. And I don't think it has to be that way. I think there's a balance that can be achieved between the both. The truth of the matter is California did not build any more prisons for many, many years. I believe it's over a decade. And as a result, they did not keep up with the prison population. And they ended up putting more inmates in facilities. And as a result, they had to decrease programming. So there was very little treatment that was occurring. So there are things that can be done to accommodate both. But you need treatment to increase supervision, day reporting centers, ankle monitors, GPS on these individuals. But the truth is you have to have consequences for these individuals that offend or reoffend or violate their conditions. And if you don't have bed space available for them, they're going to thumb their nose at the system. And we're seeing that in Fresno County right now, where if somebody does a positive drug test or violates their conditions, there's no room at the jail for them, and therefore there's no incentive for them to take treatment.
You know, Professor Hughes, I'm just wondering about this whole issue of recidivism. I guess in California, what I've seen in statistics, you would know better than me, but around in the range of 65 to 70% folks going back to jail or back to prison. And as Chief Dyer was talking about, you know, rehabilitation is one possible way to keep people from, you know, that revolving door. What kind of services are we talking about? When we talk about treatment and rehabilitation, what are we talking about? And by the way, how effective are they?
Well, there's a real variety of programs that are available, and research shows they can be effective when they're properly implemented, and that's key. You can have a great program, but if it's not properly run, then it's not going to do anyone any good. For instance, education programs in prisons have been shown to be effective in reducing reoffending. RAND released a study in conjunction with the Department of Justice just last month, And that indicated that those prisoners who took part in education programs during their sentence had 43% lower chances of returning to prison afterwards. And that ultimately is a huge cost savings. Other programs that are cost-effective and good for reducing reoffending, the cognitive behavioral programs that work to change thought patterns related to offending, that also includes anger management programs. Substance abuse treatment is absolutely crucial in terms of having effective programs within the prisons, within the jails, and, of course, for those serving time in the community. Mental health treatment we've already talked about, but that is something that really needs to be addressed as well. And also vocational training. Those are just some of the things that are available. CDCR facilities, some of the prisons are beginning to focus on these kind of issues as inmates approach their last 4 years of their sentence. Certain prisons have been designated as re-entry hubs to kind of focus on these programs that might help assist after their release. And also here in the Fresno County Jail, a new program is being started to work with those inmates who got split sentences under realignment. They serve part of the time in jail, part of the time in the community under probation supervision. And they're going to begin some programming in the community.
That seems like
in the jail.
That seems like quite a cafeteria list of options and programs. Chief Williamson, let me ask you this. Another possible solution is developing alternative punishments for, quote-unquote, technical violations. In short, is jail time the right punishment for every crime? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't believe so, and I think we have numerous programs in place, especially for first-time, second-time, third-time drug offenders or so. Problematic from a law enforcement perspective is how many chances do we want to give people? I mean, we're seeing people that are going to prison have probably been given, five to eight chances in the local courts going through there if they haven't committed a very violent offense. So I think there's a lot of things in place. Can we do more? Sure. Do I know? Not really. It's just one of those things. We can always do more with ingenuity, but at the same time, we have moved forward, and there's just some people that are going to end up in the state prison.
There's just some bad folks out there. Well, let me ask you this, Chief Williamson. Are there other cost-effective criminal justice practices, so-called smart-on-crime strategies, that can be implemented to reduce costs and improve public safety?
Well, we do a lot of it, like I said before, with dealing with the youth in our community, whether it's Boys and Girls Club, police activities leagues, those types of things. For intervention, we've used nurse-family partnerships with families who have been disjointed or have had some gang activity from the father or involved in the family. Day reporting centers have been crucial for those coming out, along with, like the professor said, substance abuse programs, mental health programs. Fire camps have been effective. Just reentry, trying to get people housing when they come back out, trying to get them jobs and those types of things. And then the monitoring, hey, we've had some success. We've had a lot of individuals cut their monitors off, though, and been on the loose, and we've had to utilize our resources to go out and find them.
Chief Dyer, are there any specific smart on crime strategies you're using in Fresno?
Well, probably day reporting centers is the one that seems to be the most effective, not only because of the fact that they have to report on a daily basis, but also because of the types of counseling, in-depth counseling that they're getting at these facilities.
So they physically have to go there?
Having inmates fast forward.
They physically have to go there?
Yes, and it's been part of their parole in the past. And Fresno opened up one of the first ones with state parole, and it's been very effective. There's treatment, there's the supervision, there's the GPS tracking of these individuals, so it's somewhat of a comprehensive approach to dealing with that individual and getting them back on the right track, not just helping them get a job, but understanding what it takes to keep a job.
And that's a 7-day-a-week situation, so they're going there on Saturdays and Sundays as well?
Yeah, I think it's dependent upon the individuals. They have initially you're going to report there more frequently. And then as you spend more time in the program, then you're required less often to be there. Yeah. So it's kind of a graduated program where you earn your way eventually to less supervision.
Okay. Well, we've only got 30 seconds left in the program, but Professor Hughes, I want to give you the last word on this. Anything else you'd suggest in terms of smart on crime strategies?
Like I said, there needs to be a combination of things that you need to have services in terms of rehabilitation programs, assistance with reentry for those coming out of facilities, and you can combine that with having surveillance like GPS, but you don't just want the surveillance, you need to have the programs available as well, the combination of the two.
Well, I want to thank our guests very much, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, Bakersfield Police Chief Greg Williamson, and Dr. Emma Hughes, a criminology professor at Fresno State. Thanks all of you for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, by just logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.